Well, they told me to keep this kind of on the brief side, and I know if I sit here too much longer, I'm going to get in trouble, and they won't invite me back for the next year. So I've only known Kyle for a short period of time, but I've got a funny feeling we're going to hear a very interesting, inspirational story. So without further ado, let's give a round of applause to Kyle.
Hey, my name is Kyle, and I am a very grateful member of the Al-Anon family group out of Huntsville, Alabama. And how much time have I got here?
Much time is on.
That's dangerous. I'm terrible with time. Are you helping me out, Victor? Have I already said something wrong?
No. You're playing with my toy. And
okay. Don't. Hey, watch what you say there, Victor. Watch what you say. For purposes of the tape, he was referring to the microphone. I'm not very good with time. Can y'all hear me okay? I am, I've always been bad with time. I wear a Mickey Mouse watch, and it actually keeps good time. But I learned about being good time when I was a football player at Auburn University back in the early 80s. And a guy by the name of Pat Dye coached there. And Pat, we had the time, and then we had Pat Dye time. And Pat Dye time was 15 minutes early everywhere. But to tell you how bad I am with time, I always tell this story. You know, we tell a lot of football stories. If you've ever been around football players, especially older ones like me, there's a lot of stories that we tell, some of which are actually true. This just happens to be one of the ones that is true. It was 1983. We had just finished a dramatic season at Auburn where we had won 10 games and lost only one. The only team to beat us that year was the number two team in the nation, the University of Texas. We'd gone through a murderous schedule in 1983, but somehow had only dropped one game, and it was the second game of our season. Ultimately, we won the SEC championship. Y'all ever heard of a guy named Bo Jackson? That's the reason you had never heard of me. I'll get to that later. But it was Bo's, this would have been Bo's sophomore year, and I was a redshirt, so I was a sophomore too. So we'd gone through this glorious season. We'd won the SEC championship, ended up going into the bowls as the number three team in the nation. The number one team in the nation was Nebraska. Number two, as I said, was Texas. Number three was Auburn. I think number four was Illinois, and number five was the University of Miami. So we're at the Sugar Bowl. Back in the old days, and I'm sure some of you will remember this, the SEC champion used to go to the Sugar Bowl. That we didn't have 85 bowls back in those games. You actually had to be good to get into a bowl game in those days. And the SEC champion went to the Sugar Bowl. I think the Southwest Conference champion, which is the, you know, where Texas used to play, went to the Cotton Bowl. And then Nebraska, which was at that time the Big Eight champion, went to the Orange Bowl. So Miami was playing Nebraska on New Year's Day. Y'all remember how fun New Year's Day used to be? Y'all remember that? Miami was playing Nebraska in the Orange Bowl. Georgia actually was playing Texas in the Cotton Bowl. Auburn was playing Michigan in the Sugar Bowl. And we don't know where Illinois is because they don't really come into factor here, so it doesn't matter. They must have been in the Rose Bowl. So we enter the ball game. The day of the ball game is number three team in the nation. Now, keep in mind, I'm just a country boy from North Alabama, a guy who dreamed of playing football in the Southeastern Conference, a guy who was not offered a scholarship, a guy who walked on, a guy who earned a scholarship, and a guy who was able to ultimately play and start off and, you know, had some good, you know, good times at Auburn. So this is a Cinderella story for the guy who's speaking to you today, right? Earlier that day in the hotel, we watched Georgia beat Texas, the number two team in the nation. Nobody expected that, and it happened. So now we're sitting at number three, Nebraska's number one. We kick off about 7 o'clock down in New Orleans in the wonderful Louisiana Superdome. And keep in mind, here I am, country boy from Alabama, out of nowhere, Louisiana Superdome, SEC champion, Sugar Bowl. Wow, this is big time, right? For me, it is. Well, a little after we kick off, guess what? Nebraska and Miami kick off down at the Orange Bowl. And as our game starts to unfold, we start hearing updates. What's going on in Miami? Well, what's going on in Miami is that Miami is upsetting Nebraska. Now, let me lay the landscape for you here. Country boy, Northeast Alabama, walk-on, Auburn, Sugar Bowl, number three, got to move up to number two because number two just got beat, and number one is getting beat. You see where I'm heading? National championship ring on my finger, great line with the babes. Right? Y'all know what I'm saying? So, there's only one little problem. We're losing. It's late in the game. It's 7-6. Michigan is beating us by 1 point. We're driving the football down the field. We call a timeout. Keep in mind, Miami is beating Nebraska in the Orange Bowl. The timeout comes. It's either a third or a fourth down late in the ball game. We call a timeout. Quarterback goes to the sidelines. I'm in the huddle, and I have this thought. And the thought is this. We're on national television. This is a critical moment in the ball game. They're not going to go to a commercial. This is my opportunity to get on television, right? So, staying in the huddle with the 10 other guys, because one guy's over here, I take my helmet off thinking, where are the cameras? And I don't know where the cameras are, so I just kind of start slowly turning in a circle in the huddle. Because I figure if they're here, there, sooner or later, they're going to be on me. And you know why they're going to be on me? Because I had already strategically placed myself right next to Bo Jackson. Made a career out of it. I got in Sports Illustrated. I've been in papers all over the Southeast. Why? Because I stood by him on the sidelines a lot. That's really the way it was. So as I'm standing there, Bo looks at me. He says, Kyle, I played fullback. Bo was a running back. Another guy named Lionel James played the other running back. And he says, hey, it's a big third down. He said, we got to have the first down. You know, you're the key block. Got to have it. Got to have it. Got to make it. We're kind of charging each other up. So I said, Bo, don't worry about it, man. I'm going to make the block. No big deal. We're going to make this first down. We're going in. We're going to score. I said, besides, if we don't, we're still going to win the game. I said, there's 9 minutes and 38 seconds left in the ball game. And he said, Kyle, there's a minute and 47 seconds left in the ball game. And I said, no, Bo, look, 9 minutes, 38 seconds left in the ball game. He said, Kyle, you see, in the Louisiana Superdome, it's 2 clocks. There's one over here that tells you what time it is. So I'm not real good with time, as you might tell. Finish the story. We did make the first down. I did make the block. We did go in. We kicked the field goal, 9-6. Miami did beat Nebraska. Woke up next morning. Somehow ended up number 3 in the nation. Don't ask me why. Some things never change, right? That was 1983. Thank you for letting me come here. I appreciate you letting me tell that story. It is a true story, but a friend of mine wanted to hear that on tape, so he's got it on tape. My story is much more than football and all of that. My story is not unlike a lot of people's story who have lived around alcoholism. You know, all the stories are the same. Let's be honest. Different players, different actors, different magnitude. All the stories are the same. The story goes something like this. Somebody we love very much has got a problem. Okay? And they're either going to seek out help to get that problem taken care of, or they're not. Then there's this other person over here who just acts freaking crazy all the time. Okay? But they don't have a problem. All right? And then the person with the problem somehow finds the grace of God to find an AA, and they start working their program. And guess what? The person over here who's going crazy all the time says, my problems are about to be over. And the person with the problem works their program and gets clean and sober. And the person over here says, my problems are over. And then the person with the problem continues to work their program. And the crazy person over here says, wait a minute, why don't I feel any better? And then the person over here with the problem really gets involved with AA. And the person over here says, why are you spending all that time down at AA? The person over here with the problem says, I thought you wanted me to stay sober. I do. Well, I go to AA, stay sober, but you don't spend any time with me. So the person with the problem starts to get well, and the person who's going crazy gets crazier. And that is my story, and that's everybody's story. My story is just very simple. Grew up in Northeast Alabama under two wonderful parents who instilled great principles in me, great work ethic. They're wonderful parents. The older I get, the more I appreciate their parenting. They had some sicknesses, though. Everybody in my family is a very small family. Everybody in my family, I believe, is an alcoholic. I mean, everybody. My parents are only children, so I didn't have any aunts and uncles and didn't have any cousins to speak of. But our little, you know, six or seven people that got together every Christmas were all drinkers. I had a grandmother that didn't drink, was a very godly woman, and she passed away, and that's the only one I can say that didn't drink. But my other grandmother, who, now that they're both passed away, I can say this, was my favorite grandmother. She was a fun, loving, wonderful person that I adored as a small child, absolutely adored. I mean, she was the type of grandmother, you know, my parents would take us over there, spend the night. My dad give her $20, take them to eat, you know, okay. And they, where my parents were going, and as soon as they hit the road, said, throw in the TV dinners. Y'all remember TV dinners? Throw in the TV dinners. We're not going to eat. We're going to ride go-karts. Woo! And we take off and we go ride go-karts. But she had a problem too. You know what her problem was? Problem is the same sickness all of you are aware of. But she was a binge drinker. She was this wonderful, loving, just fun woman that I just adored, you know, 6-9 months. And then all of a sudden she'd disappear on me. And then I'd get a phone call as a young boy that would be her. I knew it was her, but she sounded different. And she's asking for, you know, my sorry mother. And I didn't understand all this. I just grabbed the phone and run off, and it scared me to death and made me a nervous wreck. And then what would happen is we'd have to go take care of that problem. And I really didn't know what was going on, but I knew it wasn't right and it wasn't good. I knew it upset my family, and I knew that this woman that I loved so much was very different during these times. In fact, she would kind of lock herself in a room. She'd go, I guess she'd go run to the liquor store. She'd get as much liquor and beer as she could. She'd just hoard it up, bring it to the house, shut everybody out, and just, I guess, try to drink herself to death. And then, of course, when we didn't hear from her for a while, we knew what was going on. We had, you know, my parents apparently got smart enough to know that they fixed a window that they could get into the house when she was like this, because she'd shut everybody out when I answered the phones. Well, the problem with being the youngest guy in the family is you're also the smallest. And when you're the smallest, you're really the only one that can fit in the window. And as a very small child, I remember my mother would tell me, just get in there and get to the front door. And to this day, and I'm 46 years old today, and to this day, I can still smell her room on occasion when my head would poke through that window. You got to understand, this was one of my favorite people in the whole world. And I knew something was wrong. And I knew what it was about, but I didn't understand it. Because you see, when she'd got through with the quarts and quarts of liquor and the cases and cases of beer, back in the old days when we had the local drugstore, she tell them she was sick, get some cough medicine delivered to the house. And when she got through the cough medicine, she went to work on the rubbing alcohol. She went to work on the cologne. She went to work on whatever she could get. And I thought this was crazy. And the reason I knew this is because ultimately we would get her and get her home with us. And I remember my mother locking all that stuff up. You know, I'm probably 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. Why would anybody drink rubbing alcohol? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And then she'd dry out. And of course, I know now what I didn't know then. She'd been to rehab and, you know, went through the programs and tried to go through the programs. And My mother had done everything she could to try to get her dry. And she'd get back clean for a while, and there she was again, my grandmama. And everything was perfect until one day we got the call. She died in her own vomit, in her own urine, with 9 empty bottles of NyQuil laying by her bed. And for a young kid, somebody better get some Kleenex quick. I didn't understand that. But she was sick, and that's what I was told, okay? Well, I don't know what happened after that, but I can tell you this, that in my family, my mother and father began the same thing. And I think my mother was headed well on her way to the same outcome. And as a young boy, I began to learn behaviors. I learned that I possibly could fix all this. You know, I was, I learned that if I could create an environment in my home that everything was smooth, maybe problems wouldn't occur. And imagine a 15, 16-year-old boy on a Friday night. We'd grill steaks a lot on Friday night. And they'd fire up the grill at 6:30. At 9 o'clock, we still hadn't had a steak on the grill. I'm hurrying everybody along, you know, incognito, hurrying everybody along. Anything I can do, Mom? Can I make the salad, Mom? Can I set the table, Mom? Is everything, you know. What 15-year-old boy does that, right? I was doing it because I figured out the quicker I got the food in the stomach, the quicker one or two things happened. They either went to sleep or at least it was going to soak up some of the alcohol. Now, 15 years old, why is a young man having to try to figure that out? I don't know, but I'd figured it out. So around 9:30 when we finally ate, there's a lot of alcohol been drank. There's a lot of words already been said, and I'm sitting at the table to control the conversation. No, really, Mom, he didn't really mean that way. No, my Dad, she didn't really mean. And I began to learn behaviors, and I began to learn that somehow I had some control in the cosmic universe. What I mean by that? You wake up one morning getting ready to go to school. You go in and you put your red sweatshirt on. You go through that day. You get home. No problems at home. Red sweatshirt is good. Red sweatshirt works. Next day, put on a blue sweatshirt. You go to school. You come home. Bad night. Blue sweatshirt doesn't work. Now, that sounds crazy and silly, doesn't it? But in a 15, 14, 13-year-old kid's mind, it was working. And the blue sweatshirt didn't get worn ever again. Okay? Other things began to happen. I began to see my mother's condition deteriorate. And as time went on, we had a tragedy that involved my brother. I have an older brother. And without going into details, it was a tragedy. And it involved alcohol. And I was this kind of this high school football hero in town. And I thought if I play harder, if I do better, and if I'm able to take the attention away from all these problems and put them on me, then it'll all be better. And, you know, I did play hard and I did do better. And, you know, there was a lot of accolades came my way as a young man because of all that effort. Problems didn't go away. So somewhere in my early life, I decided two things. One was I wasn't ever going to participate in this because nothing good could happen with alcohol. I mean, you know, I was logical, and that was logic to me. And the second thing that I decided is if I could get my parents, my brother, and the people I loved clean and sober, then my life was going to be okay because truthfully, I was doing well in school. I was doing well in sports. You know, I was doing okay with the women, to my standards anyway. And if that was the only problem in my life. Fast forward a little bit, I go off to college, you know, ended up getting at Auburn and walking on and all that stuff. And then I got a call one night from my father, and he asked me to come home for the weekend, which was a little bit strange, but I didn't ask any questions, and I was able to go home. It was off season, and when I got there, he sat down with me and my brother, and he said that your mother had gone to rehab. And to this day, the single most courageous thing that I have ever known anybody to do. She did it on her own, and she will tell you today she did it because she didn't want me to go through what she had been through. And I love her for that. But, good, right? My problem is about to be over. So mom goes to rehab. She gets clean. Dad follows up. He gets clean. Brother goes. He gets clean. My life is great. I am as happy, and truly my prayers had been answered. This was something that I prayed for many, many years, as from a young man up, and therefore it was happening. God had seen fit to answer my prayers. Along the way, in all of those people taking their steps to go get some help, somebody did mention to me, you might need some help. Huh? Yeah, Kyle, you know, it's a family disease. I know, my whole family's got it. Well, no, here's what we're trying to say, Kyle. You may be as sick or sicker than they are. Whoa. Won't you come to my dinner at my house on Friday night and you pick out the sick ones, okay? And that's the way I felt about it. Now, given that I was an athlete and I was a very self-confident person and blah, 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 you know, I just needed them to get well. I'm okay. I go on with my life. They go on with their life. My life, I got married and had a beautiful woman, beautiful wife, and we had a beautiful life. And, you know, everybody seems to have baggage when they get into relationships, and we both brought our baggage to the house. And it set up shop there. And when the baggage starts getting to be opened and you're young and you haven't dealt with some yourself, sometimes you don't deal with her baggage very well. And neither does she deal with your baggage very well. Long story short, after about 15 or 16 years, I didn't know how to be a husband. I knew how to fix stuff or try to fix stuff. I knew how to be her father. I knew how to be her mother. I knew how to be her brother. But somewhere along the way, when you start trying and your behavior is, I got to fix it, I got to make it right, and I've got to, you remember what I said? Create an environment that there are no problems. You wear yourself out. And then one day you wake up and you're mad about it. And you start having a little pity party for yourself. And you start thinking differently. That marriage ended in divorce. I'm glad to say that today she is remarried and got two beautiful children and we are best friends, believe it or not. But at the time it was the worst part of my life. Now, in the worst part of your life, you know, and the reason it was the worst part of my life, I had felt like I'd failed two of the relationships that were so important to me. One was with God, because I was at fault in this marriage. Two was, I failed her. It was my marriage. And so I went into deep depression, and I will say this, I never contemplated actual suicide, but I, on many a night, hope I wouldn't wake up the next morning. I was at a Thanksgiving dinner with all these former drunks. My brother's married now, got two beautiful kids, and my mom and dad are there, and we're eating Thanksgiving dinner, and we're down at the beach, and, you know, at their place, and they're laughing, and everybody's having fun, and I'm sitting at the end of the table, and I'm thinking, this ain't right. And I'm starting to get mad. I'm thinking, wait a minute. I took care of all y'all's asses all your life. I prayed for y'all. You know, I helped you to bed. I made sure supper was at, you know, and I came to see you and wrote letters and, you know, worked your program for you. And y'all are happy. And I'm miserable. I said, this ain't right. And as my sponsor says, there's always this moment of clarity. And I had my moment of clarity at Thanksgiving dinner. Everybody in that room was sick. And everybody in that room had gone and sought help except me. I was mad about all of us having pneumonia and they went and got antibiotics and I still had pneumonia. They had sought out recovery and I had just sat and just continued to be sick. So I went home after Thanksgiving. That wasn't the lowest point in my life. I'm about to tell you the lowest point. Lowest point in your life comes on 9 o'clock on a Friday night, no wife. You live alone. Your dog has died. You're standing Books a Million in the self-help section. I mean, I've seen them poor slobs over in that self-help section. And I've looked over there at those folks and thought, man, can you not get your life together? You got to come in here and read a book. For God help you. And I'm there. And I am thinking to myself, you have reached an all-time low. And I'm looking through a book. And in the book, I start reading about a young man who might as well be Kyle. A young man who has spent his life trying to fix problems that were unfixable by him. They're only fixable by God. A young man who had become bitter about people getting recovery, even though that's what he prayed about his whole life. And in this book, the word Al-Anon was written. And I thought to myself, people were right. Now, just like AA, Al-Anon is not like the place you seek out on Saturday night. It's usually the last house on the street. But when you hit bottom, you hit bottom. And I was at the bottom. Now, keeping in mind my life, as far as the external world, very successful businessman, got it all together, life is great. I'm sure people knew more than I thought they knew, but the truth of the matter was I was keeping it together. But in here where it counts, in here where the peace and the joy reside, it was none of it. Now, let me state this before I go any further. I'm a believer in God and in the gospel of Jesus Christ, a staunch believer. He is a part of my life. But I didn't have any peace and joy. And that's kind of part of the program, the way I understand it. But I'd lost it. I'd lost my family. I'd lost my integrity. I had lost everything. And I started to crumble. So I go to Al-Anon. Now, this is the second time I've spoken in AA. You know, and I'm always nervous coming to an AA roundup when you're an Al-Anon guy. You know, it's kind of like we're the enemy, right? So I walk into this Al-Anon meeting, bunch of strangers, right? And keep in mind, I had gone to counselors, I'd gone to friends, I'd gone to church, I'd gone to a lot of places trying to articulate what's going on inside of me. And I sat in a room, bunch of strangers. I don't see anything. People are very nice. They introduced themselves, you know. I kind of just sat there and was listening. And then we went through the steps, went through the traditions, we went through a few announcements and some other things, and all of a sudden people started reading some literature and started sharing. And my gosh, was I ever overwhelmed when I heard people articulating exactly how I feel. I had never heard anybody say it out loud. I didn't know there was another person in the world that understood what I was going on, and perfect strangers were talking about my emotions. Of living with and loving somebody with a disease. Of detachment and things they started to teach. But at that meeting, it was all about, my gosh, they know me and they don't know me. I didn't say anything that meeting, but I promise you, they hooked me. Now, I'm a cynic and I'm thinking, did they know all that? And they just said all that because, you know, I'm starting to think, because I'd heard Al-Anon was a cult, okay? And I'm thinking, hey, they put the hook on me. But I kept going back. And I remember the guy who ultimately became my sponsor. He says, you know, just keep coming back. You know, give us 6 meetings. Just give us 6 meetings. That's all we're asking for, 6 meetings. And so I kept going back. What I began to understand was, yes, I was sick. And let me explain to you, I'm still sick, okay? I got better medicine now, but I'm still sick. And I war against my problems every day, just like an alcoholic wars against his or hers every day. But I got tools now in my toolbox. Toolbox, you say, I didn't even have a toolbox, more or less it being empty. I got tools now. And the first thing, you remember when I was talking about the red sweatshirt and the blue sweatshirt? The first thing that happened to me was an awareness of my craziness, quite honestly. As I began to get into the program, I started beginning to become aware of who Kyle really was on the inside, not who Kyle portrayed on the outside, not who Kyle thought he was on the inside, nor who Kyle wanted you to think he was on the inside, but who Kyle really was. I started realizing that this little blue sweatshirt, red sweatshirt had been in me my whole life. And at 40 plus years old, a senior executive in a publicly traded company who is in charge of a budget over $50 million and close to 50 employees, I had to park in the same parking space every day. I had to go through a routine in the morning of shower, brush, shave. I had to make sure that toothpaste was in the same place. I had to do so many crazy, idiotic, insane things. No wonder I'm wore out. Because every moment of my life had a direct cosmic effect on the outcome of the world. It's funny now. And I became aware that everything I was doing, I was trying to control, because my life had been so out of control. If I could control the stuff that I could control, then I could control everything. Wow. When you look in the mirror and you have thought of yourself as a highly intelligent, I have a Juris Doctorate degree. I'm a graduate of Auburn University. Some of you Georgia fans may not consider that intelligent. Over in Alabama, we consider that intelligent. I'd been a very successful businessman. I had done a lot of things. You know, I mean, just my resume was pretty good. And I was crippled and paralyzed if my parking space was not exactly right. I mean, that's tough to admit. But guess what? People in my program said, it's reality. Admit it. Accept it. Work on it. And I remember standing up in front of my mirror. Many times I've done this. I have to do it sometimes. And I have to say, this is real. I do feel like this. I may not like it, but it is real. And God helped me make it different tomorrow when I stand here. Really that simple. I had to learn how to realize that, man, it's okay if I don't park there. And force myself to park somewhere else. And then allow the world to happen. And let God be God. And let me go back to what I'm supposed to be doing. I talk about my divorce. I'm able to talk about it now. I became everything except what I was supposed to be. I became mother, father, brother. But I wasn't husband. I needed to be husband. I needed to be supporter, lover, encourager. The same thing had happened in my life. I had become all these things that I wasn't supposed to be. And what I was supposed to be was who I was. And I couldn't control the alcoholic or the alcoholism. And through the years, that's come back a little bit with some of these people I love. And, you know, they battle with it, and I understand that. But it's different now. It's different now because now that is their journey. And I become an encourager, a supporter, and I love them. but it's their journey. And I realize that God has them on their journey for them, not for me. See, everything was about me. You're having problems over there, and your life's a mess because of something I've done, or something I should have done, or something I hadn't done yet. That was my view of life. And one day God said to me, "Who do you think you are?" I mean, really, how much power did I actually give you when you were born? Because I really think I've screwed up here, Kyle. And I started to realize through the program and through a bunch of loving people that just love me and are on it, love me enough to be honest with me, to say, no. That's going on in their life because God has something for them. And it made me start to realize I could sit on my hands and close my mouth and just pray and ask God to be there for them. Ask God to give me the wisdom to know what was my responsibility and what wasn't my responsibility. And it has changed my life forever. All of us have the same story. We truly do. I mean, whether you're on the AA side of things or the Al-Anon side of things. But let me tell you, AA guys, we're a lot sicker than y'all are. We are. Because all the folks that had trouble with alcoholism, at the end of the day, they were medicating a problem, right? They had something to go to. We didn't have anything to go to, so we just got crazier. That was our medication. Get crazier. My sponsor tells a story. He gets up and he says, "Yes," he said, "I lived in an alcoholic home and we had verbal abuse and we had, physical abuse and we had this and we had this and we had this." And then he says, "But that wasn't my dad, the alcoholic. That was my mom." And there's a lot of truth in that. Those of us who live around people we love who have this problem, we don't understand why you got it to begin with. We absolutely look at you and say, "Just stop." I mean, it's really that simple. Just stop. Quit. And then when you don't, we think you're weak. We think it's a moral issue. We think all of the above. Because we haven't gone and got ourselves educated at that point. We don't understand that it is a compulsion in you. We don't understand that you probably want to quit. And you say, "Tomorrow I will." And then when you don't, whew, you go down. We don't understand why I'm not important enough to you for you to stop your behavior. Or your children are not important. Or your job. Or whatever it is. We don't understand that. We never will understand it. Because we don't have the allergy. But we got our own set of problems over here. And our problems are this. We got to allow God to take you on your journey. And sometimes that journey is painful. Sometimes that journey is not fun to watch. And quite honestly, sometimes that journey is not fun for us. And we'd like to tell God what to do with your journey. Sometimes we do. But that's why He's God. And I'm not. So what I'd say to you in closing here today is this. Number one, thank you for letting me come and share. Jerry said he's going to pay me for my mileage. I said, "Nope, you're not going to rob me of my blessing. I don't want a penny of that. This is a blessing for me to share this with you." Number two is this. We're all in this together, folks. Okay? And we all come in with our own baggage. And some of us deal with our baggage and others deal with it. But we're all, as long as we're trying, we can get there. My brother is an alcoholic. My mother is an alcoholic. My brother and I love each other. He's my hero. How about that? My hero is an alcoholic. And he and I sat down and talked about it. And his daughter's going through it now. And one day he said to me, "Everything I went through in my life has prepared me for this moment." And that meant so much to me, because in my tough times, I didn't understand that. But today, everything I've gone through has prepared me for today. And my testimony and my life continues on. And, you know, although, you know, I've told God a couple of times, I've got enough character now, God. We don't need any more character building. I know in whom I believe, and I know that this program that I'm in teaches me that I'm not God. He is. And if I get out of the way, take care of myself, which sounded selfish, by the way, when I first heard it. You got to take care of yourself, Kyle. That's the most selfish bunch of SOBs I've ever been around in my life, first time I heard that. I mean, my gosh, these people need my help. No, they don't need your help. But you understand what I'm saying. So, thank you very much for having me here. And we got a saying on my football team, and that's a whole other thing that I coach, is just keep your feet moving. It was the advice my brother gave to me when I was going through all the hell I was going through. He said, just keep your feet moving. In football, we've been taught that from day one. If you keep your feet moving, you got a chance to break out of the pack and score. If you stop your feet, you've determined the outcome. So just keep your feet moving. Thank y'all.
See, I told you I thought we were going to have a great story here tonight. Thank you. Is it talking about appreciation for...